This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboy's Booksplode, Starman Omnibus, Volume 1. I owe you, don't I? A little light today, but tomorrow, oh tomorrow. I owe you, don't I? I know it ain't the money. Hey, welcome to iFanboy's first episode of Booksplode. And what that is, for those of you who, we're making it up as we go, but ifanboy.com is our website, and we are going to talk about a single volume, a graphic novel or a book that we think deserves talking about, because for whatever reason we thought this was the best way to do it. I am Josh Flanagan. With me is Connor Kilpatrick.
Hello, everyone.
And Sonia Harris.
Hiya.
And Paul Montgomery.
Hello, the world.
Hello, the world. Sonia and Paul are writers for ifanboy.com, and Connor, you've met.
What we're Sorry, gonna do is... I apologize. I was drunk.
Yeah, it's...
That's my standard greeting upon meeting someone.
Always with the apologies.
Yes. Oh,
but that doesn't pay the bills, dude.
I know.
You got babies you got to take care of. Anyway... we wanted to take some time and really get into talking about the first volume of the Starman Omnibus. Came out just over a year ago now, and it's one of those things where we could have done a video show, but we would have had to wait the requisite 5 years for all of it to come out.
That soon?
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
There's going to be 6 volumes of this, and if all goes well, then maybe we'll do one on all of them, provided we're still kicking around when we're in our late 60s. Anyway... in case you don't know, Starman is sort of the seminal DC series of I guess the mid-90s. It's the one that sort of paved the way for the future of what comics would become, you know, in sort of the era of the 90s that was about a whole lot of different things. But this is one of the great series from it. Basically, Starman in this refers mostly to Jack Knight, who is the son of Ted Knight, who's been around in DC and National Comics for decades and decades, was part of the All-Star Squadron and Justice Society. And this is the new take, the updated version on the future of the legacy. And I guess we should just get started and talk about like whether you guys read it at the time or heard about it or you know, what you thought of it beforehand. Connor, what...
Hey, who did this mysterious series, Josh?
See, I told you that would happen. James Robinson was a new and up-and-coming writer at the time, and Tony Harris was a new and up-and-coming artist at the time. So neither of them were really well-known, and they made their bones on this book. And since then, they've become relatively big names in the industry, and this is considered to be sort of the masterwork for Robinson at this point.
Kind of like his Sandman. I mean,
yeah.
It's kind of the long series he's known for, and sort of – I don't want to say co-sonnet because he does good work, but like it's the one that everyone sort – he sort of –
You can live off this a while.
He's going to live off these omnibus too.
In like the way that Francis Ford Coppola does.
Right. Yeah. And again, I like his stuff now, but it's very much the series he's tied to and will forever be tied to.
Yeah. That was a horrible statement. That made him sound bad now, and that's not what I meant to do, but he could. Like, if he just produced all shit after this, it wouldn't matter. Because he'd be like, did Starman.
Right. So Starman started, as Josh mentioned, Jack Knight is the main character, and he first appeared in Zero Hour, the absolutely horrible miniseries in 1994. And then from there, I guess that was part of the outgrowth that they seated him in there. Because that 0 hour mini had to deal with the end of the Justice Society, mm-hmm. where they were. This is old. This is all pre the current Justice Society, which is very popular. And it's different. If you look back then, they were all old men like they would be. They were all in their 70s and 80s. And it was kind of ridiculous. These old guys running around, and then they eventually were de-aged to the point where they're sort of middle-aged now, and that's a little more palatable in terms of these guys running around in their costumes. But back then they were old men, so at this point they brought in the new Starman, who was the new generation, kind of what DC does with their heroes. So this is where we are, and this is where we begin.
So we're talking about from the beginning of 1995, end of 1994. That's when these comics came out. And
you weren't reading comics then, right,
Jeff? No, not at all.
And I was, and where Sonia and Paul was a baby, and
I was 11 years old.
Jesus,
son of a bitch.
And I'm 8,000 years old. So,
Sonia, were you reading comics, or were you reading this?
I was reading comics, but I wasn't reading this. No, I had a bit of a lull in the 90s when I was trying to avoid comics because everyone thought I was insane. And this passed me by, sadly, but now I have the joy of having the omnibus to read, so that's much more fun.
And I was reading comics back then. We were just starting college, and I was not reading this series, even though I heard a lot about it. And it's funny, I have a funny history with this, is because this first omnibus is basically the first two trades that came out, and I read them. Many years later, probably in the early 2000s, Josh had all the trades, or all the trades that you could get at the time. And I went to visit him in Los Angeles one week and read the first two. And he later gave them to me as a Christmas present, the first two trades. And I reread them. Yeah. And the first omnibus came out, and I reread that. And it was basically all I've ever read of the series is the first two trades. And I've read it 3 or 4 times.
Mm-hmm. You haven't read the second one yet?
No, I haven't read the second one yet. I've been waiting in preparation to do this show, and also because my stack is...
The second one, it came out already, and the third one's about to come out. So we'll probably get to those a little quicker. And then after the third one, you'll probably have to wait a while.
Right, so I've been rereading over and over these first 16 issues. I know them very well.
Well, I suppose you do. Paul, what do you know about this?
Well, this is sort of... my favorite corner of the DC universe. Like, this is, I've been told that I would love this book, though I hadn't read it until this weekend. And I mean, I love all the JSA stuff and all the nostalgic stuff. And, I'd been told that this would be right up my alley, 'cause there's carnival freaks and antique collectors and stuff like that. And, I'd started it, and I wasn't so hot on it, and I got yelled at, and that got put in my file at the iFanboy offices.
Paul has a big file.
I have a big file, basically this is my penance talking about this today. So we'll get into my thoughts later.
For my own part, it's one of those things that I heard about, and I got through the first like 5 trades, and I remember I got stuck on the trades because they didn't number them back then. And even more frustratingly, like...
They still don't number them, by the way.
They still don't, but... a couple of, like, 3 and 4 are out of print, but, you know, or I don't even know if they're still printing the trades. But either way, so you don't know which one's next. So every time I was in a place where I was like, maybe I'll pick one of these up, I couldn't ever remember which one it was. Even to the point where, like, on Amazon, I couldn't quite figure out what the next one was, because even the issues in the trades were not in the order that they came out.
Oh, I hated that.
Because of
I
the way
hated
that the series
that.
Was... told. Like, they would basically, they built in a thing where there'd be an arc that Tony Harris drew, and then there would be like a special issue, a Times Past issue, and then there would be another arc, and they put the arcs together and then put all the Times Past together in its own book, and you know, did it like that.
I just hate that. They do that so much, and it's like, no, just give it to us as they meant it. It's like when you buy a best of compilation album by an artist you like, and you don't get, because what I like about this is it was coming out in the 90s, and if you think about what was coming out in the 90s, there was good stuff, but it was not like it is now where you could just pick and choose. You really had to seek it out. And so the fact that this has the staying power it has is incredible. And I want to get it as the creator meant it to be consumed. I want it in the order he made it.
So I had like the first 5 trades for years. I mean, like really, really long time. And then... like a year and a half ago, actually probably almost 2 years ago, I ended up with like a tax rebate, and I was like, screw this, and I bought all the 5 that I needed. So I read the whole thing straight through again, and literally, I think, weeks after I got them, like, they announced the omnibus. So that happened again. That happens to me a lot. But when I it's funny because I really like I'd been hearing about the series for a while and I liked it, but obviously I didn't like it enough to really follow up on finishing it after the five. I spoke fairly highly, but I never went and bothered to finish it. And I guess that'll play in a little about what we're going to talk about. So why don't we talk about now that we've been talking for a while, whether anybody liked it or what you thought of it. Connor, you read it many times now, and you've only read the first two parts. So what are you thinking about at this point?
There's more?
Yeah, there is.
I actually really do like it. I think it read better in Omnibus than it did in the trades for whatever reason. I don't know if the issues are out of a different order than they are in the trades or not.
They are slightly.
I like a lot of things about it. It is very much of the times. It is a very firmly in the 90s, which can be good and bad. Mm-hmm. Bad in terms of fashion, which was horrific, and bad. The pop culture references are very much of the 90s, which really, if you're old enough, it's all right. But it still puts you right back in there, which I don't know if it's good.
Some of them are of the 40s and 50s though, so it's hard to tell.
Right, but the 90s ones stand way out, and if that happens in any book, and that's just a pet peeve. Pop culture references tend to be really of the current pop culture references. References that are happening as the book's coming out tend to really date the book. But anyway,
Chris Isaac is the epitome of cool in this book.
Hey, he was the epitome of cool.
I understand that.
Is he not still?
He has a talk show. Yeah.
What? And the fact that the whole like. I don't know, like the evil Manson figure, the Charles Manson figure, the what's it called, Ragdoll. I mean, that was, of its time, but I think it was a really strong, iconic use of that
kind totally. I think it's more like the fact that I guess we should kind of talk about Jack Knight.
Yes.
Are you talking about his layering? Because if he lived in San Francisco, he'd dress that way anyway, because it gets cold and hot and cold and hot. You need T-shirts, jackets.
I didn't mean that at all.
Oh, okay.
I think we should talk about the fact that if you look in the back of the omnibus, they have the character designs, and originally Jack and I had a ponytail.
We should all thank
Tony Harris or whoever made that decision to lose the ponytail, because that would have been a whole different book.
And he had like a scarf, like a cowl neck T-shirt.
I literally think that if they had come out with a ponytail, it would be like the Hitman books today. You just couldn't get them, and no one would care.
Just because of a ponytail?
Yeah, it would have swung the tides. Basically, I mean, this is all, the whole thing is going to be Jack Knight's story. And it's about your ability to get on board with him. Jack Knight is basically the son of Ted Knight, who was Starman for a long time. Starman is a red outfit with a yellow star and a red hooded thing with a fin on top of it and a big green cape. It's a goofy looking costume. And the whole approach that Jack Knight has about his father is, it's a goofy looking costume and I don't want to be caught dead doing it, and basically spends his whole life rebelling against what that is. And so
that's not actually true. He spends his whole adulthood repressing the memory of wanting to be a superhero when he was a kid. Like, he idolizes his dad.
This is true. But when you meet him, the first thought that you have about him is that he wants nothing to do with that part of the whole thing, and he's a junk dealer. He's a collectible enthusiast and dealer.
Yeah, I think you need to change the language you're using. First of all, we don't call them junk dealers because they deal something else.
Well,
but,
he calls it junk dealer. I mean, that's
I know, but that's in mid-90s.
No, his father calls it a junk dealer, and he says, "Don't use that word." He actually doesn't.
Okay.
Yeah, but junk means drugs, dude. Like, I'm just saying right now.
Well, don't talk to me like I'm new to the streets.
Sorry, it just sounds weird when you say he's a junk dealer. It's like,
that's
oh my
what I would
God.
Say if I was in a bad 80s cop show. He's
but
dealing junk.
I'm just saying.
No,
I'm saying
literally...
the thing is, the fact is, I grew up with a house filled with that kind of ephemera.
Heroin.
With Bakelite salt and pepper pots from the 30s.
It's
funny
because I don't know what any of that stuff is that he's referring to.
Oh, my God. It's everything that's beautiful about product design. And it made the book 1,000 times more interesting for me because I grew up around that stuff. I spent years searching for those kind of things. I love that kind of thing. I do think that it, if you think the book is dated to the 90s, I think it lends much more to Art Deco. And I think that's fantastic, because if you look at Tony Harris's art, he either has a Deco feel like he does in this, or you go to something like Ex Machina where he goes crazy Art Nouveau. Some of the covers he does in this, but it's so Deco, which is perfect for all the junk.
It's totally Deco. The art style is totally Art Deco. That's not the pop culture reference. That's totally different. That was more beside the point.
Think about it, '50s was really fashionable in the early '90s, so it kind of makes sense.
Well, the thing is,
that wasn't what I was talking about. We're getting hung up on a
So basically, Jack is obsessed with all of these old things, and he has a shop where he sells this kind of stuff. And the basic premise is that Davey, who is Jack's older brother, slightly older brother, becomes Starman, and right at the beginning, here's your big spoiler, by the way, deal with it, he gets killed. And so the idea is somebody has to take up this mantle, because Opal City, which is, by the way, pretty much a character in this story, needs a Starman, and so he reluctantly agrees to take care of it, you know, for the meantime while it's needed, and thus begins our story. That's about right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have trouble with Jack, because he is not your typical hero type. He doesn't really want to be doing it. He's not even the reluctant hero. He's kind of the annoyed hero. He doesn't really want to be there. He doesn't like the costumes. He doesn't like the tropes of being a superhero. And I think it probably would piss off a lot of people who do like that. I know, thinking back, one of the reasons why I didn't read this book is because at the time it was very fashionable to have the heroes out of their costumes mm-hmm. and hate the costumes and hate the code names. And I always like that stuff. That's
right.
The superhero comics. So that's part of the reason why I didn't read it.
You were Davey.
Basically, yeah. I mean, that was some. I didn't find it cool to hate the costumes. I found it cool to be in the costumes. So that's why one of the reasons why I did it. But
he's an everyman. He's meant for us to be able to relate to him. And if you were told personally to put on a costume, wouldn't you be a bit uncomfortable?
Actually,
that?
I don't think that's true.
I think Connor would not want to wear spandex.
No,
that's just my personal feeling.
No, but Jack's not an everyman, and that's actually kind of the point of the whole story.
You think so?
Have you read the whole thing?
He thinks he is. That's the point.
He wants to be.
Exactly. He perceives he's trying very much to create himself as a regular guy who doesn't like that kind of thing. And a regular guy would not want to wear that stuff.
I think more so he wants himself to be a cool guy. Because it was written by and there's a lot of James Robinson in this. I mean, like in the disastrous interview I did with him, that's one of the things that came out of it. But also you read it as you go through this and other things. You know, James was a guy in his mid-20s in Los Angeles trying to make it in comics and be really cool. I don't know if you've seen him. Like, he's got tattoos all over his arm. He's a cool guy. And I think that part of this is that trying to be ironically detached, you know, hipper than everybody and sort of denying the things that you think are sincerely cool or the things that you feel sincerely about, because sincerity is death, sort of. So he surrounds himself with all this other stuff. And all these things.
That was all it was. Then I wouldn't like the book. But the brilliance is that underneath it all, he really does like that stuff.
Well, Paul, you read the first few of them and you weren't down with it. I'm going to assume that's because Jack is kind of a dick.
Yeah. No, exactly what we're talking about was a really important turn for me when I realized that the book is more aware than I thought it was. That. There was that level that he thought he didn't want this, but he actually, you know, I like that idea that he repressed the memory of wanting to be a superhero, and he thought that it was his brother who wanted to be Starman, when it was actually him who longed to be a superhero and adjusting to that. So I turned around on the book after the first arc, really, the first. I think like the first zero through three.
Mm-hmm. Missed.
After those issues, and also when that's when the art sort of took a little bit of a turn as well.
Well, I think that one of the things that's really interesting about this, and I agree with you in that I don't think that the first few of them, granted, now he had everything planned out really well, and everything that is stuff that's in the beginning of this, we're not going to talk about the stuff that comes later, but I will say that there's a lot of things early in this book, there are a lot of seeds that are planted that come into fruition over the course of the 80 issues of this series. I mean, from right in the beginning, which is pretty impressive. But I would agree that the first 3-4 issues are pretty rough. They're overwritten.
And he would agree with that in the afterword.
Yes.
I was just reading. He's not so hot on the art or even his own writing. So that was some nice honesty to see. But it did actually improve exponentially as the book went on. So
I'm very glad to hear that. And you've lost, first of all, by saying things like that, we're losing a trope that we've had against you for a while, and I feel bad about that. But
I'm going to find something new.
Well, what's the kind of stuff that really stuck out to you in this that you liked, Paul?
Yeah, one thing that I really loved about this and we haven't touched on yet is, and it gets talked about with Starman a lot, is the setting with Opal City and the love he has for creating this place and talking about it. And there's a lot of poetry about it. Like a lot of the narration boxes mm-hmm. are about how the city looks and the sensory experience of the city. And I really, really like that. You don't get that sense with a lot of other books. Most attention is paid towards the action or the characters. And here he really makes sure that this world is fully established and you sort of fall in love with that. So I really like that aspect of the book.
Well, Sonia, you must have been into the fact that Opal City is like Art Deco heaven.
Yeah, that was interesting to me. I mean, the book is about looking back at these Golden Age heroes. So I felt like he used Jack's job, he used the city, he used everything he could to sort of pay homage to that era and that time. It was a lot of fun, but I didn't think I didn't like the way it was drawn that much compared to what I've seen Tony Harris do in other places, but I liked the style very much. It just wasn't, if I'd never seen Tony Harris do anything else, I would have been blown away. And like Robinson says in the introduction, or is it in the afterword? I don't remember. But he talks about Tony Harris's sort of chiaroscuro style with a lot of shadow mm-hmm. and how much mm-hmm. the story needed that. And so that for me was very important to know that that was a conscious choice. And I mean, from what I know about Robinson, he did a lot of describing the panels and how the layouts would look. Mm-hmm. And so I hadn't realized that until afterwards, until reading about it afterwards, how important that was to him and how conscious he was about creating that mood, because it's not like a Golden Age comic. And yet every aspect of the art story pays homage to it. So mm-hmm. it's a very interesting dichotomy in that way.
It's an interesting, like the art is, it's funny because Tony Harris is such a distinctive style now, but at this point it was still developing. And if you've read, I guess it's in the back of the Ex Machina books, right, Connor? Where he uses a lot of photo
references. The trades. Yeah, in the back of the trades, they have whole things about how he does with all the photo referencing and the actors he uses.
But he doesn't use that on this. And that's
right. Actually, I actually prefer this to his current work mm-hmm. because
it's
he's
more
actually
comedy, isn't it?
Well, he's actually, and I don't want to say he's not drawing now, but it's more, to me, it's more pure because he's actually just drawing people. Mm-hmm. And you can see instances in here where he's photo referencing faces, and that's normal. That happens in all art, even paint, you know, the famous painters of all
sure.
time. But I just feel like there's more actual drawing here than there is photographs and then light boxing. And that's fine, and I don't want to knock that. I just prefer the more pure style of this.
One of the things that's interesting, Paul touched on, is that he got, like he sort of worked it out after a few issues, I think. And I would totally agree with that, in that like the first few, like it's a weird looking book. And like sort of the faces kind of overact. And that
what?
Might be...
Oh, come on. Really? You think so?
Yeah.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
You know, compared to... Right. I mean, Jack's really, really expressive. And it's almost like he'd taken... Like he in the script, you see... you know, he makes this kind of really pissed off face. And then so Tony like looks in a mirror, and this is what an animator would do, and like made the most expressive, like if you were doing an improv show and you needed to express something, like I feel like the characters do that a lot. There's not a ton of subtlety in the facial.
A lot of sneering.
Mike Roma, there are people with very expressive faces.
Well,
and
right.
It's useful for us to know what's going on.
But it's, I mean, I'm saying he does it more than a lot of people do. In comics, and that's not a good or a bad thing, but I notice it's not necessarily natural, which again isn't you know, it's not trying to go for that realistic sort of thing. It's different.
With that in mind, then what did you think of the issue that was drawn by Matt Smith? Because I thought that was one of the strongest ones.
Is that issue
11? Yeah.
11, yeah.
Issue 11 is my favorite issue in this because issue 11 is...
The story is incredible.
The story is incredible. Basically, it's called 13 Years Ago, and it's one of the Time's Past tales. And so every, like I said, every arc or every chunk of issues or so, another artist would come on and do a story called Times Past. And what it would do is it would take you back to an earlier point in one of the characters' lives or in Opal City's past, and you would sort of revel in that for a while. And it's funny because a lot of times with issues like this, they would be called Connor's evil word that he doesn't like, filler.
Right.
And in this, again, I just have to say, like, stick with it in the respect that all of this stuff gets paid off. It all ends up building one giant tapestry. And it's really amazing.
Even if it doesn't, what does it matter? It's a fantastic issue.
Exactly.
But it really does. You need this information.
Absolutely. Okay, so basically the story is that there was a character it says 13 years ago, called Ragdoll. And Ragdoll was a sort of a bullshit, you know, B-rate villain. No big deal. And he'd been put in jail a lot. And then all of a sudden, at one point, he figured out that he could act like a cult leader and convince people to do horrible things for him, like a Charlie Manson or something like that. And the Justice Society...
I read this... Apparently, this... Sorry to interject, but didn't... This character existed, but wasn't nearly as scary before James Robinson got hold of him.
No. And he's like the Purple Man from Alias. Mm-hmm. Like, he was there, but... You know, and then Bendis came along, made him really scary. I consider this sort of similar.
I thought there was Robinson. Oh, I see. Bendis made the Purple Man. I got you. Sorry.
So Jay Garrick, Flash, Green Lantern, Alan Scott, Starman, Ted Knight, the older, Rex. I forget his Harris. No, that's not right. That's an actor. Our Man, and then Dr. Midnight get together, and they're like, we have to deal with this Ragdoll, and basically they kill him. That's the deal. And the idea is about, like, there's not a Golden Age story that I've ever read before, or a story of the Golden Age characters where they have to take these kind of extreme measures. And it's this really...
Whoa. You must not have read a lot of Golden Age stories then.
Well, okay, I haven't. At least, I guess at least in...
It was the Silver Age where they went to the no kill and stuff. I mean,
even if you look at like the way that they do Golden Age type stuff now, like they're always like the grandfatherly figures.
That's the looking back. I mean, if you do the actual
exactly.
books, like Bucky's machine gunning Nazis and Batman shot people.
Now it's all okay. Yeah, now it's all rose tinted spectacles and no violence. Back in the day, it was yay, right on America, kill.
But either way, that's the environment in which you get this story.
No, yeah, I think you're right. You wouldn't see a flashback of this now, or it's not right. less likely to see a...
Like, but I just love the idea that it's a parsing of what it means for the heroes to have killed somebody, which for most superhero comics these days, even now, is... It's a big deal. Like, you know, like, everybody knows, like, it was a big deal that Barry Allen killed, you know, Professor Zoom, or that Wonder Woman killed Max Lord. Is that it?
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, but he had her under mind control. That was
right,
never
clear. But then that's always the out. And in this story, it takes the straight-up approach. Listen, we don't know exactly who did it, but somebody did it, and really, in the end, it was the right move.
Well, he pulls the old, I'm going to come back and kill your family, and they could kind of just go, shrug, kill.
Yeah, and I love that, because the thing is, even now, you really only get romantic flashbacks of these characters.
Right.
And the idea here is that they were in a real world. And it wasn't even – I don't want to say – because that's such a – since 1986, that's the comic thing. These are guys living in the real world. But this was even – it wasn't – I wouldn't call this gritty. It was just
– As a matter of fact, it's like people who fought in World War II. Mm-hmm. I killed Nazis because I had to. Like, that's kind of like the same mindset.
Yeah.
One little thing about this bugged me. It wasn't even this issue, and this is a totally minor thing, but I'm surprised it happened, was that this issue itself is alluded to earlier when he tells Jack a story of them fighting Ragman briefly. And in that issue, they spell Alan's name wrong the entire time.
I did notice that.
And I'm surprised they didn't fix that in the reprint. That's all I'm saying.
I love that. You know, that's a thing that... It doesn't happen so much now, but in the 90s, like the idea of wearing, like they had the Charlie Manson shirt or even, you know, in the 70s, like wearing Nazi paraphernalia, as like ironic statements, like he has Jack doing that and he's got a Ragman shirt and he's like, whatever, everybody does it. It's cool. You know? And the father's like, you don't understand what it was actually like. And I really enjoyed that story. But that is one of those things that like, that was a trend. That isn't really happening so much now. Although, I guess, if Scarface was real.
people have more taste now. I don't know. Maybe it's the PC thing. Okay, but getting back to issue 11, I just really was so jarred by how it looked. I mean, it was so different from the rest of the comics, so much more brutal and simplistic and almost childlike. Some of it was, disappointing in some ways, because I would have loved to have seen how Harris did this, but I feel like it really put, as you say, it's an important story, and it put like a period at the end of the sentence, really, by making it stand out and be separate and different. It almost looked like simplistic woodcuts by Edvard Munch. It was really, really strongly sad and simple, and
I'm
it worked well.
What Paul thinks, because Paul's the big JSA guy. I mean, we all like it, but he really is.
I love the JSA. No, and I love this. And when I flipped through, I was like, oh god, how many more pages? And I saw the JSA here. This gave me hope.
Early
on in the book, when I didn't like that first arc, I was like, oh, I have so many more. There's 17 issues in here. And then when I saw that the JSA were coming up, that gave me hope. And then I slowly, as I progressed through the issues, I realized I'm not agonizing over this. I'm actually enjoying the ride. So
you are going to get to,
yay.
I don't remember which book it's in, but you were going to get to an issue eventually with the original Sandman, Wesley Dodds. And it is going to be the greatest thing you've ever read.
It's going to blow my mind. I'm going
to
love it.
I swear to God, it's one of my favorite arcs I've ever read. And it, like, basically one of the, you're starting to see it here. And again, Jack hasn't really accepted what this is, but one of the big themes of this is, and it's a thing that in DC is commonplace at this point. It's every like JSA issue and every Flash issue is about the heritage of the things that go backwards, and that's kind of what this is about. And what's really interesting is that Robinson has taken most of this book, and he hasn't really let Jack go towards it at all. Like, you're getting hints at it, but Jack is unlikable for the most part for a while.
Oh, but see, he's doing it with everything but the
I agree with Sonya. I think it's very obvious, and I think it's very, I mean, it's like in everything Jack does, it says he really likes what he's doing. He just refuses to admit it because he doesn't want to look non-cool.
Sure.
He has those thought bubbles. He's constantly thinking about how much he respects and loves what has gone on in the past, but he doesn't want to say it, and I completely understand that.
Well, the fact that he
in your mid-20s, you don't want to talk about the uncool thing being cool, because then you'll look uncool. But
I don't care about anything. I'm bored, and I don't care. I mean, I spent my entire 20s doing that.
Those are some of my favorite moments, is where he's talking with his dad, and there's those thought boxes where he says what he wants to say to his dad, and he doesn't, and his dad says, were you going to say something? And he says, oh, nothing, never mind.
Those are really done.
Yeah.
It's poignant.
I'm learning a lot going through those, just in how those conversations are done. Another couple of my favorite issues are the ones, and supposedly this happens about once a year, but he goes to meet with his dead brother, in the graveyard or wherever. Jack goes to meet with the ghost of his brother Davey, and they have these conversations. Yeah, it's a black and white issue. These are some of my favorites of the whole thing too. Did you guys like that stuff, or
didn't you? You know what you were saying about his face being too expressive? That was the only one where I felt like that, and I guess it's because he was so upset through that whole issue.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, he's got to do a lot here with, I mean, basically, this is a whole issue of talking.
And a lot of the issues, really, the main thing here is character development and environment, and the plot is like secondary a lot of the time, which is nice. It is a nice technique for building characters you empathize with. But yeah, sometimes he's wailing and it's kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, whatever, you're upset. I know, people die.
There's a lot of building towards fights and then they don't really happen. It just sort of gets talked out. And
well,
I could
they
see,
are brothers,
I,
but yeah.
Oh, no, I didn't mean that issue specifically. I was talking about the whole thing where there's a lot of building up to confrontations. And like the issue with the Hawaiian shirt.
I love
that. I love that issue. And they're gonna talk. It's like they're gonna fight over the shirt, and they realize, well, why are we fighting about this? You just buy the shirt.
Have some money.
Yeah. Let's fight, or you can just buy it from me. All right.
Yeah. But I love that issue. It's refreshing to see that.
Yeah, so I love that issue because it showed again in this current climate where if you deign to do a one shot issue, people freak out all over the place because you're meandering from the main story, and that was such a beautifully done issue. that it made me miss those type of things that used to happen way, way more often, you know, 15 years.
The idea that a one-shot is negative is insane. It used to, first of all, it was always used to be one-shots. And second, how the fuck are you supposed to build character? How on earth are we supposed to relate to these people if they never do anything but run around like lunatics?
Well, you know, this is one of the things about this series that I think is really... It basically, from a structure standpoint, it's very similar to what I to like Preacher, meaning it's a long, long thing. It's actually even longer than Preacher by about 20 issues, I think. But there are diversions and there are miniseries and there are things that all fill in the world like that. And it kind of existed on its own, from as far as I know. It's like a main DC title, and he exists in the DC universe. But for the most part, it wasn't there's a crossover later, but.
But when he does crossovers, when he does meet other villains, he makes it really believable and plausible, which, and almost serious, which in the 90s wasn't really happening. It was all like tongue-in-cheek and like, oh, we're so ridiculous.
It's more that, I mean, that the events of the main DC universe weren't affecting this book. It's not like you know, like how books cross over into the Avengers and what happens there. So Spider-Man ends up going into Dark Avengers Tower, that kind of thing.
Spider-Man's Marvel.
I know, but the point being that it happens in books.
I don't mean to be a fanboy.
So one of the things that really strikes me about this book is that there are a lot of characters that come out of it who I love. Like, they're favorite characters of mine. Was there anyone who really struck you? For me, like, and they haven't even built him up very much at this point, but Ted Knight is this really fascinating character, because he's not, you know, he's kind of pissy to his son in the same way. But like, there's this affection that sort of becomes apparent between them over time. But I also just like that he's like this science-based guy, and he's a hero, but that's only part of it. He's just a really unique hero to me for some reason.
Yeah, we haven't seen a lot of him. I like the O'Dares a lot. I like the whole family of cops, and they're all different, and they're all kind of wacky in different ways. And I like the Shade. I mean, we haven't talked about the Shade at all, but the Shade is
awesome.
You see, I mean, I'm again, having only read the first two trades 45 times, he seems to be the main supporting character and the most interesting supporting character.
I know, I keep wanting to ask you what happens next, but obviously you've only had time to read the first two trades 45 times.
Here's what I'll tell you about him. You know, like, the fact is, you don't know what side he's on.
Yeah.
And that they're going to play that out until you can't take it anymore.
He's the character I most relate to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, he's the one. Because
you're made
when
of
I was
fist,
reading this.
Paul. Is that it? Right. Is that why? Yeah.
He's the guy who knew Oscar Wilde. And he just, like, it's funny because, Paul, you'll do pieces on the site where you'll get into some sort of different types of writing. And like,
that's my crazy fan fiction, yes.
Yeah, and it, you know what, though? But it, like, when you do stuff like that, it makes me think of The Shade. So when I hear that you didn't like it, I'm like, how can you not like The Shade? The Shade.
Because I didn't really get to The Shade yet when I was saying that. So
you're so indignant. Let the man want what he wants. You know,
he doesn't though. Sometimes people know what's best for other people.
Oh, Josh, you're not his mom. Jesus.
No, but when doing comic review criticism, it is best to not jump out early because it will bite you in the ass. We've all learned this.
Yes, that's true. Although I've made snap judgments and not wanted to articulate them because I didn't want to be making a snap judgment, and then read like four trades and it's just confirmed exactly what I thought all along.
That is the double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. What do you think of the villain? Basically, it starts off and the villain is the Mist, and it is Ted Knight's old enemy, but then there's some shenanigans and... Exactly. Nash, who the daughter of the Mist, becomes the new Mist.
Isn't it horrible, that moment when he breaks, when his mind goes? It's really sad, really, really depressing, because you don't get the Flash, the original Flash, walking around going, what's my name again? Are we at work? Where are we?
When somebody writes that story, it is going to win an Eisner Award. When somebody does, I mean, like, if they had let Jay Garrick just age... Or like, what if
Alzheimer's?
Or like,
I don't. Yeah, you never see that characters with Alzheimer's. It's really hard watching the Mist go through that. I'm sorry.
And the Mist is a genuinely bad character. The only redeeming feature about him was that he fought in, I think they said, the Great War, which I assume would be World War I.
Right.
And they say, basically, there's a bit where they want to get the dad's medal back from World War I. It's like the one good thing he ever did in his life. But other than that, like, he's a killer. He's not one of those villains who doesn't really kill anybody. They just steal, you know. He's a killer. He's a horrible person. And to watch him go through this, awful. And I'm really surprised nobody's done that. Like, Kingdom Come Superman starts to lose it.
Because nobody wants to read that.
I know, it's horrible.
No one.
Jesus, Josh, you know.
Oh my God, I'm totally going to write like the Tim Drake taking care of slowly.
Who changes the diapers in that home? Oh, Jesus.
Oh. You think they got hate mail for turning Hal Jordan crazy?
Yeah, you got
you're
it. Right.
You're going to get death threats for giving Jay Garrick all signs. And one of them going to be from me.
Yeah, it's going to be from me, too.
That's fine.
We're going to co-write a letter.
I'm just
you
saying,
sick fuck.
If that happened, you would feel it. Like you would that would affect you, and because in this book it's affecting you, and it's a horrible character, not horrible
with liver spots, and he doesn't trim his nails.
I didn't feel that he was that evil. He just really hated Knight like a lot.
He's a killer.
Yeah,
care about the people that he killed in the pursuits of his short term desires.
Yeah, some people are like that.
Well, this doesn't make it okay.
I think we're seeing insight into Sonya's.
Oh, shit.
I like Nash, though. I think Nash is great.
Nash is a wonderful, wonderful sort of bad guy to put Jack against, I think. And it's one
she
of those...
can be a little crazier. Does she go a little crazier?
I think by the end, I mean, the thing is, that last sort of arc, which is, by the way, from a structure standpoint, the you know, Jack's day, or, like, it was Ted's day, or no, Jack's day part one, and then Ted's day. And then one of the O'Dare's day, and then...
All of the O'Dare's.
All the O'Dare's.
Oh, did they all get one? And then at the end...
They're all the same one. It was the O'Dare day.
And then it was... Yeah. Then the end was Jack's day part two. Mm. And it's just such a cool structure of how to do issues. And I
think... So it was a five-issue arc, and every issue told the same day from different characters' perspectives. I really think, on a whole, I was impressed by the structure of work. Mm-hmm. Just knowing what little I know from the whole series, that he's already seeding stuff and seeing where he's seeding stuff, and... I think one of the things he really has well done at this point, this is early in his career, is structuring interesting ways. And I like foreshadowing. I like flash forwarding. I like saying, well, in 10 years, he's going to be dead. Mm-hmm. I like knowing. Mm-hmm. I like that kind of stuff. And
it's terribly filmic, don't you think? He builds it like you'd build a great movie with tiny, tiny hints of how amazing it's going
to
be.
Except in a way, it's almost not comparable to a movie because a movie is only 2 hours. It's more like a TV, like The Wire, or something that's like a series of novels that are built up from a seed. And that to me, that's as satisfying as storytelling gets from my point of view. Like, that's the thing I love the most, is a long, well constructed, well thought out story that takes years to tell. And I mean, that's so impressive. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah. And that's amazing. This was an early book he was doing. It's insane, really, that he was able to do this.
Well, that brings up another point. I mean, so one of the things that I would probably say that he needed to work on, which even got better as he went, but there's times where he's very wordy. Like, he's taking a lot of time to say things. It's almost like he wanted to do prose, but was trying to mix the two.
It's a lot of stream of conscious writing. Yeah.
I do think it works for this because it's very, I don't want to say anachronistic, but the Opal City and the environment, the characters are very old fashioned. And I think the wordiness fits into the setting. I think.
Yeah, now the only thing, and Connor, I don't know if you'll back me up on this one, but on 11, that was the weird thing. I suddenly became aware of someone writing it. And you've read it a million times, so maybe you know what I mean. But you know how you get so lost in a book that you don't realize it's being written? It's just existing and flowing into you. And then with 11, I guess because he was trying to echo that era, there was a structure to the sentences that sometimes made it feel clunky.
I think that there's times where it was clunky. In the terms of, like, when a writer is new, they tend to put too much on a comic book page. And I think that this was happening at points. Like, when you turn a page and you just see text all over the place, it doesn't bode well to sort of feel like you're moving through it. To me,
honestly, I never felt that way, and I know when I'm looking at it, I see that's what you mean. Yeah. But because of the art and the combination and the flow, it just felt like something I was moving through very organic.
I think it also depends on how much you connect to what is being written, mm-hmm. and how well the words are put together.
I think
see what Sonya's saying at all. I didn't feel like it was over wordy because I was really connecting to what was being written about.
I think it's just one of those things. Like, if you read like early Alan Moore, I think he did the same thing. And I do think that you know, James Robinson sort of styles himself as like this was him trying to do like Alan Moore type of work.
But the idea that there can be too many words on the page is so strange to me. I don't know. There are as many words as there need to be.
No. As I think,
I totally agree with that. Yeah.
Well, Paul, you've read like you, I don't know who else, but I know
that
you've read.
I'm with Josh on this. I think that it's in any kind of writing. In you know, I studied screenwriting myself. You do have a tendency when you're first starting out that you need to
express
just
everything.
Pile up the words, express everything. Yeah, and yeah. I think that there are a lot of moments where it works and a lot of moments where it doesn't in this book, and it gets better as it goes along.
Yeah.
And I do think that, I mean, there is an objectivity to it, but there's also a subjective thing where we were talking about if you're on the same wavelength as the writer is, and that's a personal thing, you might not notice it. Mm-hmm. So that's where Sonia and Connor are not noticing it because they're enjoying the ride. Whereas I guess me and Josh were looking at it, and it's just like a subjective thing. If you're not on the same wavelength and you're not in the right mood for that, it's not going to work for you.
It's a brave choice because in that sense you do risk slowing people down, I guess, and sort of losing them. So in that sense, it's a good thing.
Like, now wait, like where's the problem? This isn't manga. We're not supposed to read each page in 2.4 seconds. I mean, I think it's okay for it to take longer.
Are you telling me you've never gotten
to
a comic book page and hit a block of text and you were just like, get on with it?
I've never had that happen.
No, I've never had that happen. I think maybe you're reading comics wrong.
Oh,
I don't know that it's the amount of words. It's the
backwards?
Way things are phrased. I think
it's all about the writing. It's all about the quality of the writing. If the quality of the writing is bad, then a lot of it's going to be really bad. But if the quality of writing is good,
it stands exactly.
He's writing very specifically here, though. So you have to be. It's like the rhythm of the writing, where he's doing fragments and stuff like that. So if you're not at the same pace as he is, then it's going to feel clunky. But if you're at the same rhythm as he is, then you're going to follow each beat as it goes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a subjective thing.
Mm-hmm. I like the guy who I think of in this is Michael Chabon. And I think whenever I start reading one of his books, I haven't read a ton of them, but like he's sort of overly flowery.
Yes.
For my taste, I suppose, especially at the beginning. And then again, eventually you sort of get locked into it and you get used to it. I guess Neal Stephenson probably does the same thing, where like he's just talking so much and being so in detail.
Are you talking about the novels? Or are you talking about novels?
Yeah. Novels, the same thing. I mean, it's just like the
same as comics.
As far as language and telling a story through words, yes. Like you can be flowery, you can start to use. I think this is written very prosaically.
I mean, they're different, but okay. You can say they're the same, but they're different things. They're different mediums. They use language completely differently because with a comic, you have imagery to pull your eye around and
to
move.
If I'm looking at a page of stuff that is two guys talking or a cityscape the whole time, and I'm looking at a block of text that's the same thing as a paragraph from a book, which could exist in either place. It does something to either slow you down or speed you up or do something. But either way, the language that's used in that, you can use 5 words to describe something or you can use 20 words to describe something. And that works the same in either way mechanically.
Maybe you should try Archie comics. They don't have so many words.
Or that.
Please don't kill me now. I'm sorry. It's just so weird. It's just
okay. Here's a thought. Okay, so Sonia and Connor, you really liked the art, right? Like from the beginning.
I got better, but I like it. I'm saying I liked him more. I like him more here than I do like currently, but I like them both.
I think
Connor.
I had an aversion to the art in the beginning, where I understood what they were going for, but knowing what he's capable of now, I thought it was very crude. So I was focused more on the writing, so that if there was anything that felt off, I noticed that more. Like where like the art couldn't bolster it. It couldn't like help me along.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't enjoying the visuals as much. So all I had was that prose.
Mm.
So that's one of the things that I experienced with this book was that if I noticed that if I'm not enjoying the art, then I won't give the writing as much of a head start, I guess. I don't know.
To me, I'm used to sort of rules of thumb of how much stuff you want to put in one panel. Like, if the word balloon is bigger than the subject inside the thing, like, maybe you should spread it out more or something like that. It's, I mean, it's a style thing. It's a pacing thing. And the thing is, he slows down on it as he goes. One of the things about Tony Harris is that's interesting is that if you look at a page of Ex Machina now, you will rarely see a page with more than 3 or 4 panels on it. And in this, he was doing, you know, like 6, 7, 8 panel pages.
Because James Robinson didn't write Ex Machina.
I know, but the difference being that, like, now Tony Harris only, like, I've heard, like, Bendis say, like, he won't work with Tony Harris because he writes too many panels for something, and Tony won't.
Tony Harris is big enough now where people write.
No, I know. It's just interesting.
And I read that was James Robinson. I mean, from what I've read, that was James Robinson's choice. He was planning out the pages.
Mm-hmm. Right. The point being that back then he could do that, whereas if he tried to do this book now, he wouldn't have Tony Harris draw it.
Yeah. And, you know, it should be said, like, they had a bit of a falling out on this book.
Yeah.
You know, later on. And it's funny because you liked issue 11 a lot, and I think the artist who follows Tony Harris, I'm going to say it, Peter Snezbear. I actually heard somebody say it correctly the other day, and it's much simpler than I'm doing. But,
Peter IKEA tabletop.
Yeah, that guy. The Pwang chair guy.
Right.
Snezbear, like, he's got a completely different style.
Peter Allen Wrench.
Yeah. You know how many of those I have? Jesus.
I really like what he did on Light Brigade with Peter Tomasi, so I'm looking forward to that. So he takes over on Arc Duties, or?
Yeah, about halfway through.
Okay.
I'm really curious as to what that is like.
It works. That's all I can tell you.
It's like a spoiler. It's like you ruined a surprise.
You know what's funny is that I wasn't really cognizant. By the time that happens, you're so into the story that you almost, because you're also used to, you know, there's a couple of different artists that show up in here. You kind of don't notice.
Some big name people will draw some of this stuff. Yeah.
You kind of don't notice the switchover until you realize that it's happened for a while. You know what I mean?
Because
this one issue was it the O'Dares where like Stuart Immonen and Chris Sprouse and Andrew Robinson, Gary Erskine and Amanda Connor all did stuff. I didn't really notice the differences in most of the pages.
No, I didn't either. But the thing is, like, you get used to the artist sort of switching around time and again. So when you get to an issue that's not the same, you're like, oh, okay, this is just a different. And then all of a sudden you realize, like, hey, this isn't changing like 6 or 8 issues. Oh, it seems like there's a new series artist. Like, I was 2 trades in and was like, oh, look.
Wow. Wow. That sounds kind of intense. I want to see that so much.
It's going to be worth the wait. And in 2016, you will enjoy the hell out of it. So I assume everybody's got their volume 2s ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And excited about the future.
Wait, there's more of this book?
It's funny because, like, this is really very good, but I mean, he just gets better and it gets better, and you know, all the stuff's there, but like his mechanics and the way that it all moves, it's really something to see. And there's going to be a couple of issues in there which are sort of the memory, like the issues you remember forever. Like, you could ask me right now, I could tell you 3 issues right away, you know, that, and it's pretty good all the way through. There's one rough patch, but you'll probably disagree with me when it comes up.
Why would I disagree with you? Why would you say that? I don't know what you mean.
Because it's your autonomic response.
See, that's so untrue. I agreed with everything you said about it up until the whole too many words.
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I not allowed to make jokes? Because you were... No? Is that...
I think you both... You're going to have to go to HR together. We're going to have to work this out in mediation.
I think we should take some time to acknowledge the humility at which I admitted that I was wrong about Starman, and I didn't make a big deal about it.
Well, I did get the memo that you sent, and you sent bound, and, you know, you didn't really need the 45-point type. I was wrong. Starman was good.
I think that I deserve a pat on the back for not, you know, griping about it.
Don't you think you also deserve a rebuke for your earlier... aspersions?
Those are weird words. It's like an agricultural term.
Would you say
term.
That there's a way that I could phrase them quicker and easier?
Yeah, he's going to give you shit for not liking it. That's what he means.
What I'm going to say is nothing to do with what the internet's going to do to him when this hits the air. So,
I still don't like Kingdom Come.
That's fine.
Okay. They'll just be mad at me for bullying you, Josh.
Anything else?
It's out in Thunderdome next week.
Yeah.
Booksplode number 2, Thunderdome.
It'll be odd how she's not on the next volume, but whatever. Are we wrapped with this book? Are we any further points that anyone wants to make?
I quite liked it. I think people talk about James Robinson all the time about how because he's currently writing Superman books or two of them, and they talk about how his structure is great. He does great long form storytelling, and you may not like him at first, but it'll pay off. And I like him from the get go. Especially here, he's really locked into these characters, and I really enjoyed. I mean, I can see, again, having read this 45,000 times, keeps getting bigger every time we talk about it, which is, never mind. I just think he's really locked in these characters, and it's going to be interesting. I'm really looking forward to the next one. I've got it sitting here next to me, and the third one's coming out soon, and there's going to be 3 more after that. I'm really excited.
Cool.
And, it's great to find these long-form stories and have them be as good as you hope they will be.
Oh, there's nothing better. There's just nothing better than, going through Preacher or going through...
It's kind of akin to finding, when I read Preacher in the same... around 2000 and trades for the first time. It's like, oh, this is very good.
Yeah.
But Preacher starts off with such a bang. I mean, I don't know. This isn't the same.
No, I didn't say the same. I said it's the same thing as discovering a series. That's the only similarity I'm making since Preacher and Starman.
It does, I think, it's a different kind of story, but at the end, I'll be interested to see what you think.
Yeah, hooked in.
All right, folks. You got any questions, you can go to ifanboy.com. You can post on the thread about this show. You can always email us at contact@ifanboy.com, and you can read Paul and Sonia's work on the site every single week. Paul on Tuesday, Sonia on Thursdays. Connor and I are always around there, too. But we alternate, so I can't pin it down.
Jeez.
Awesome. All right, thanks, guys.
So typical, a piece of you for a piece of me.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, one of the things is you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.